Yes. Hey, buddies. Welcome to the Zoom edition. Are you guys pretty excited about the show today? I'm actually kind of
excited.
But also trying to be cool and calm at the same time, because that's how we roll, you know. This guest that we have this evening, he really doesn't need an introduction, but I like to say that I like to brag that he's like one of our tribe, because he's from the Bay Area, and I like to say, yeah, he's like one of us, but he's totally probably not. But he's like a pivotal figure in my comics career. I don't know about you guys, but so we have here Adrian Tumina here in the program. We all know him from the creator of comic Optic Nerve, which started out as a self-published mini comic, and it was published by Drawn and Quarterly. He's done, you know, illustration work for, you know, New Yorker and New York Times, won numerous awards, you know, for his book Killing and Dying, and he's done, you know, Shortcomings, all this great stuff. He has his latest book, is just released last week. He's been going through this crazy, amazing Zoom book tour for the book, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Cartoonist. And he would have been traveling around the country, but sadly, because of the whole shelter in place, COVID, we've been lucky to see him doing these amazing Zooms with all these amazing, like, interviewers, like Michael Sheen and Randall Park. And now it's us, and I'm thankful that he's joining this ragtag bunch, the Comics Cop Trap. So give it up for Adrian Tumina.
Hey,
lucky to have it.
Oh,
hey Adrian.
Hello, everybody. I'm just as happy to be here with you guys as I was to be on Zoom with everybody else.
Oh,
that's so nice.
I mean, I was watching all those Zooms, and I was like thinking, I don't know if we're going to get Adrian, because I have a feeling he might be so sick of Zoom meetings.
Oh, yeah, that's not your fault, though, but yeah.
Oh, thank you.
It's a lot of, I mean, you know, I've actually been kind of enjoying it. Like, I feel like some of the conversations have ended up being better than they would have been if we were on a stage in front of an audience. They felt more kind of intimate and relaxed and everything, and I feel like especially when you know, you're on stage with another person, you're kind of putting on a show and you're altering your affect based on what you hear back from the audience, and you know, and I don't know if it would be the same for everybody, but for me, I felt like I was able to be more myself in this format than being on a stage and kind of doing a performance or something like that.
It must be nice to not have to like actually travel too, right? Like, I know that sometimes traveling is fun, but sometimes, like, as you know, as written in your book, you know, traveling
for yeah,
could be a drag.
I mean, you know, I was dreading it at first when we were planning the tour earlier in the year, and I was just thinking about how much of the summer I was going to have to be away, or actually at the time we thought the book would be out in the spring, and so how much I'd have to be away and what that would mean for my wife with the kids and everything like that. And then I also had this fear that the actual tour for this book would end up eclipsing the material in the book in terms of awkward humiliations and tour, you know, snafus and all those things. And I had this feeling like, oh, I'm going to want to stop the presses or do a second edition before the first one even gets out there or something like that.
Like an addendum.
Yeah. Right. And that's maybe just like, a mini comic that adds on to it or something like that.
Maybe this can make the addendum. So maybe we can
concoct
a humiliation.
Let's try to make this really awkward.
I've had a few things that by now would have made the cut in the book if I was still working on it.
Cross off my name. I want you to cross it off so that people can still kind of see who it is.
No, there's no real names under there. It's all just made up.
I don't know. I thought I was able to read some of those.
Oh, no.
Oh, well.
Well,
I think it was fun for us as being in the actual comics community to try to figure out who is that person that Adrian's talking about, especially the one in Comic-Con, or who is that person, like the whole comics crew. Like, I didn't know that even existed.
I've, just, Yeah, I've already received a totally incorrect apology. Like, I got an apology.
Oh, that's fun.
From someone who apparently thought that they had, you know, transgressed in some way, and that they owed me that they saw themselves in one of the characters in the book, and I was happy to let them off the hook and say, you know, I haven't been harboring some grudge about you or anything like that.
Well, I hope you strung them along a little bit, like, oh yeah, you know.
Well, I mean,
it wasn't you, but there was other that one time.
Yeah, well,
you mentioned it.
It made me wonder what the person was apologizing for.
yeah, totally. Did you feel like when you were doing this that, like, you know, because, you know, for us as a cartoonist, you know, we were there with you, you know, like, whether we were not at your level or, you know, whatever. But every time you put out something and go to a Comic-Con, you have the same, you know, experiences and stuff like that. Did you feel like maybe that it was too specific to cartoonists ever?
I was worried about that. Yeah. I mean, I really thought that there were a lot of times when I was sort of on the fence about details to include or just even whole anecdotes to include. And I'd have this thought of like, yeah, you know, like the average person is not going to even understand this, but I don't want to, I kind of trap myself in a style of working from the first page. And then later on, there were scenes where I wanted to do kind of like a Chester Brown thing where like, I would like turn to the reader and explain something. Cause sometimes it just felt too convoluted. And then I thought, no, that's, so anyway, there was a lot of trickery to make it seem smooth and understated and readable. And I would sort of try to embed information in dialogue and everything, but it was tricky. But there were definitely points where I thought, you know, I can think of like five friends of mine who are going to know what this is about, and everybody else, it's going to be meaningless or something like that. But I was fine. I sort of had it in my mind that this was going to be like a weird niche kind of book, and it's separate from the rest of my career, that maybe would just appeal to, like, you know, my 10 best cartooning friends or something like that. So that's how I approached it. And then just anything that any kind of audience beyond that, I just felt like would feel like a bonus for me.
So how did it feel like, you know, getting back into doing autobio as opposed to doing more fictional or fictionalized work, like getting back in that mindset and making certain decisions, like just like that? Was it hard for you, or?
It should have been easy, because the idea of this book was to kind of give myself a little break, because the previous book from start to finish took almost 7 years, which is kind of insane because it's not that big of a book, but I was busy during that time. I had two, you know, both my daughters were born during that time, but after that experience, I felt like, yeah, I don't want to dive right into another 7-year project. And so the idea of this was to be something a little easier for me and quicker to produce. But I found that I'd gotten so, you know, after 7 years of working exclusively in that mode, like my mind, I was convinced, like, that's the way to make comics now. You come up with these fictional stories and you sort of imbue these made up characters and stories with some of your life experiences. And that's the best way to express yourself, because there's a freedom with that veil of fiction. And so I've said this before, but like, even when the book was done and like being printed, or even beyond that, I'd wake up in the middle of the night or something, and I'd have an idea for another story that is exactly in the mode of the killing and dying stories. It would just be like another, you know, like a full color kind of somber, you know, serious, precisely drawn thing, which, you know, I did not want to do. So I had to sort of readjust my thinking and force myself to do this, which ended up being a little tricky because I was so used to hiding behind characters and everything after all that time.
I had another like autobio question where I went back and looked at the previous few issues of Optic Nerve.
Yeah.
Where it seemed like you had kind of precursors to this book almost. You did a few autobio strips in those.
Yeah.
And they were all kind of on the theme of resisting change in the world, like being resistant to like taking part in social media or digital art, stuff like that. Right. And
Yeah. By the way, those are not collected in any book. So those are only in the comic books.
Okay. But hey, those nerds. First, I mean, those did seem like the same style. Like it seemed like, am I right in thinking that that was kind of like got you?
Yeah, they're very,
path?
they're similar. In fact, I even went back and looked at those at the time to think like, does any of this material belong in this book? Like, could I sort of reformat it to fit in the book? Cause the drawing style is pretty similar, but I think you're right. Like there was some sort of, those were sort of like a series of like, wrestling with change, but especially about comics format and graphic novels versus pamphlets and all that kind of stuff. So it didn't feel quite right for this
book. But I do think there is some consistency. Like this book, at some point you do get into some pretty existential issues and self-analysis. And that's what I thought was really interesting about those strips is how, you know, you're expressing like how you feel about this thing, but you're pretty self-critical too. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering about when you do strips like that, are you documenting your own self-criticism process, or is it the act of making the comics that kind of brings those thoughts out of you?
It's a tough question. This was the least premeditated book of anything I've done. There wasn't a lot of advanced writing of the material before I started drawing it, and not a lot of editing either. So it was the closest I've come to working in sort of a improvisational make it up as you go approach, which is not anywhere close to like the way someone like Chris Ware does it, where he literally is making it up panel by panel. But so I was trying to do some amount of writing and decision making as I drew it. So I think some of that analysis or whatever that you're talking about was coming through, some by design, but a lot subconsciously as the story was unfolding. Like I would have the idea of the actual physical things that occurred, and then more of the thoughts and things like that would occur to me as I was drawing it.
I think we've talked in the past how you've kind of changed your process a bit. That
because
of your life, situation, that a lot of it's been using more portable type tools that are easy to deal with. So, can you talk more about how that worked itself in the book, and was that a definitive decision on how to draw it that way as opposed to how you normally do it?
Yeah, this was definitely my most stripped down set of art supplies.
I loved it.
It was literally, I'm looking right now, and it was there was one pen that I used for the lettering and one pen that I used for all the drawing. And that's it, which is a big change from a brush and a bunch of different pens. And, this one, I didn't use rulers or anything to draw the straight lines in the backgrounds or the panel border. So it was just sort of, trying to keep a steady hand. So that was liberating and sped up the process quite a bit. I don't know if that would be true for everyone, but for me, stripping down the tools and just loosening up in terms of the style and kind of letting myself off the hook a little bit in terms of the backgrounds, I went from, like with Killing and Dying, I think an average page took me like between 5 days and a week. And when I was really concentrating exclusively on this book, I was doing a page a day, which is sort of like a huge change for me.
I love the art here. I've been a big, I promised myself I wouldn't fanboy out too much on you, but like I've been a huge fan of your comics for a long time.
Thank you.
But this art is like amazing to me. Like,
oh really? Thank you.
Your economy of lines.
But also
you just have three lines for a face and it was it'll look like a face, and it to me, you know, like that part is a great is amazing. And how you use texture in some of the parts to emphasize, you know, and it's kind of masterful. And I think you know, a lot of it is because you had you've drawn it so much that this kind of is very instinctual to you.
Yeah.
But I do want to know, you know, just that you're talking about it, like as a cartoonist, I do want to know those pens that you use.
Oh, sure.
I'm sure there's a bunch of people out there listening that are drawing comics that are like,
cool talk.
Fill us the pens.
Sure. Yeah. I always want to know that stuff too. Although I should say that for me, one of the biggest roadblocks I've had over my career in terms of productivity is this obsession with tools and the right tools and expensive tools and expensive paper and all that stuff that I got really hung up on. And freeing myself of that has been really useful. So I don't want to perpetuate that by saying, this is the stuff you need to use. Yeah. Not that these tools are very expensive, but that's my preface to answering your question, and which is to say, you know, use whatever it takes to make it look the way you want it and look good, you know.
You don't want to be like how to draw comics the Marvel way.
Well, that was one piece of the puzzle for me. I mean, I had that book from an early age, and I would obsess over those Buscema drawings of all the tools and everything. But so for this book, I used a mechanical pencil with blue lead in it to pencil it. And then I did the panel borders and the dialogue balloons and the lettering with a pit marker, just like a felt tip pen that has waterproof ink in it. And then the rest of it, all the artwork was drawn with a Japanese nib. The company's called Tachikawa. And it's, which one is it? It's the school nib. It's called school nib. And I just bought a ton of them from, should I plug the location that I got them?
Do it. I'm going to go on the website right now as we're talking.
Right. Yeah. I always got them from Jet Pens, which is, I think, a Bay Area company. And yeah, they don't, for me, they didn't last a long time. Like I had to sort of get used to, like I'm used to having the same brush that I've had for 15 years or something like that. So I had to get used to this disposable aspect of like buying a bunch of those pit markers and buying a whole bunch of those Tachikawa nibs. And sometimes in the middle of the page, just ripping the nib out and getting a new one or throwing the pen out and getting a new one. So that took some adjusting, but it's all so much cheaper than other equipment. Like when I was using rapidographs and sable hair brushes and all that stuff, where you had no choice but to clean it and fix it and make it work if you were having problems.
Kind of a theme of some of the other cartoonists that we've talked to, that they feel a bit liberated once they get a process down that allows them to draw faster and looser and not worry, not get hung up on materials, like just use whatever pen.
Who else has talked about that?
I feel like Chuck Forsman talked to us a little bit about that. I don't know, who else have we talked to recently about that?
Ebony Flowers, maybe?
Yeah.
And what size, Adrian, did you do these pages for? Because, you know, with the nib and everything.
Let me think. I'm trying to remember. Well, I someone who's better at math can figure it out, but I scanned them at 66%.
Oh, wow.
So whatever that means.
I think it's bigger. I think a lot of the materials is just our age, right? Like, one, we've learned enough to know that like it all reproduces the same, you know. And the second thing, I think we're just so busy.
Yeah.
You can't sit down at a drawing table and tape the corners. And that's like crazy. So like, I think when all of us have gotten older and we have kids and stuff like that and responsibilities, you got to figure out how to do it like on the couch while you're watching, Wee Bears or whatever.
Yeah.
But do you do that? I mean, do that for future books? I mean, you did say it was depends on how you want the page to look, but
yeah. Is, well,
but something. You don't tape your pages anymore? I feel like you still
tape No, I do. Yeah, I was thinking, Tin, you're going too far with this.
Yeah, I know. I was like,
not taping it down and working on the couch, and you know,
like Tin draws on an iPad.
Yeah, let's not go too crazy. Well, I mean, I'm sort of in a bit of a bind because in addition to feeling like I want to liberate myself and be free and use cheaper materials and everything, I also feel like I'm now in this pattern where I want to make each book somehow different from the one prior. I've been trying to work on that for like the last few books. And so now I'm sort of in that same place that I was after finishing Killing and Dying, which is my mind is still in the zone of the new book. And I feel like I could sit down and do, you know, 20 more little stories that would match it exactly. But I feel like I have to force myself to do something else. So I think it's going to be another shift of some kind, and you know, I might be forced to break out the expensive tools again.
We don't mind the 12 or 20 stories you still have in
you. I love that there, you know, like I read Killing and Dying, love Killing and Dying, and then into this book where it's like a really neat progression of like, okay, well, I read this great book and now I'm going to read a little bit about like maybe not this the process of the specific book, but basically like, you know, kind of how this book came about, you know, like you know, mm-hmm. author and stuff. I think that would be like, I think it's a great rhythm, you know, like to get this like fiction book and then to get a little bit of a nonfiction slant to it. And yeah, I think that's it's a really cool you know, like train, you know.
Yeah, no, I sort of feel, I mean, I haven't decided exactly what I'm going to do for my next book, but I do have this I have this sort of nagging feeling in the back of my mind, like, now I got to remind people that I know how to do color or something like that, or that I can draw backgrounds in perspective if I need to.
no one cares about that.
I know.
We know you could do it all.
I was just, when I was getting ready for this, I was having a flashback to,
oh gosh,
I feel like there was some time when we were talking before where, Tin, was it you that you had some memory of seeing me like win some prize or something?
Oh,
like,
man,
that?
And I was just gonna tell that story. I love that story.
All right, well, you should tell it because I feel like now reading this book, it sort of puts it all in context for you, the idea of,
yeah,
as I'm winning some whatever it was, you know.
We should all try to come up with like an awkward Adrian Tamina story while Tin is telling this story. Let me think.
I have two Adrian Tamina stories now.
Oh, so no.
This story happened at the Piedmont Theater, and we were at a movie, and it was like, so at the Piedmont, they would give out these prizes when it's the premiere day. It was like a poster or whatever. It just happens to be a poster I really wanted or something.
What was it? Do you even remember what it was?
No, I totally forgot what it was, but I was very excited for it. And I was like, I remember sitting there with Lark going, yes, this is mine. The winner is Adrian. And I just remember saying, Adrian Tamina wins everything. Because, you know, like, and then at that moment though, like everybody was quiet. So I basically just screamed this. I don't know if you heard it or not. Lark was just like so embarrassed. She was like, oh my God, you know, and that's like, but then my new story is I was so excited to get this book that I got into a car accident.
And
what? I heard that it was out on Tuesday. And so I was like, oh man, it's out. And like, the pandemic, I get in my car, I'm like, I'm gonna drive to a bookstore, the Escapist right now and get it. I'm so excited. So I'm driving. And then, like, I make this illegal U-turn because I'm, like, super excited to get the book.
Oh, my God.
Like, I hit a car. It's not that bad. Everybody. but then, and I'm like, oh, sorry. And I remember just being like, okay, here's my shirts. Go. I want to go in and get this book. And I go in. And, of course, it's a Tuesday, and comic stores, you get books on Wednesdays.
Right, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, we don't have it yet. I'm like, oh, my God.
Oh, so, yeah.
It's my second Tamina's story. And
That's right. In the old days of going to stores and everything, that's right. I feel like records came out on Tuesdays and comics came out on Wednesdays. Yeah.
I think I'm really excited about this book because I really did think, oh man, it's going to be things I am going to really relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, and like, again, I don't know how many other people will relate to it.
I
honestly think a lot of people will, because, it's, you know, the same experiences can be applied to so many different industries.
Right.
The same, you know, like whatever. And it was true. It was like, I felt you when you sat there and nobody came to a signing, you know, like,
yeah.
Really feel that, you know. And I think when you were doing all the interviews with all the other people, I was like, oh yeah, those people are big names, but when he interviews with us, I think we will really feel more than Randall Park. Well, maybe not, but you know what I mean?
We feel the hurt.
That experience.
Well, yeah, talking to some of those people, it was interesting what they thought were their analogous situations. Like,
oh yeah?
Well, one time I accidentally sent too nice of a gift to David Lynch or something like that. I was like, that's not quite the same as... when I found out I was lactose intolerant.
Oh no, yeah, oh gosh.
But anyway, Tin, I just wanted you to think back on that Piedmont theater scene and also think of it in the context of this book, because there's a lot of things in this book that seem like I'm going through an experience that should be a great moment of pride or satisfaction or triumph, and it's often not the case.
Yeah, I that's the best.
That's a really good point, yeah.
Because even on the outside, if someone was reading this right now, they're like, is Adrian just humble bragging?
But
you are so vulnerable in this book to let us know your thoughts. And I would, if I drew a book about myself, I would never be the a-hole, you know, I'd be the cool guy. You know, it's hard to do that. Joe Matt does it amazingly. Mm-hmm. And I think you really did this really great.
I mean, that was it wasn't a natural thing. It was sort of a decision I made because, every anecdote in this book could have, with just like one panel, could have added with like a little smart-ass remark from me that where I end with the last word or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And I was trying to make a book that I wish my cartoonist friends would make their version of, you know?
Yeah.
When I was thinking about that, I was like, you know, I don't want to see anecdote after anecdote where the protagonist, like in a sitcom, gets the little zinger at the end at the other person's expense or something like that. So it was important to me that while there are some like grudges and a little bit of revenge in there, that a lot of it is directed, the butt of the joke is most often me, I think.
Yeah.
And you also directly at a point in the book reflect back on how you had a very good career, but the parts that stick out to you are these little humiliations and slights and stuff.
Yeah. And yeah.
So it's sort of the point in a way, like.
Yeah. Well, when I was thinking about the whole structure of the book, and then when I wrote that part into the book that sort of explained it in a way, I started thinking like, this is going to sounds so weird to people, and I think some people might, you know, be put off by it, and it just won't make sense to anyone. But I was listening to a podcast, and it was like two comedians. It was like, I forget who they were now. I think one of them was Conan O'Brien, and then I forget who the other guy was. But they were talking about something similar to this, about how like, oh, sure, I was, you know, hosting a late night talk show, but I was just fixated on this one negative review or, you know, and I was just thinking like, okay, so this maybe is not specific to me, but it might be specific to all people, or at least all creative people somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a brilliant structural, like, I think that the structure of the book is just so effective, how the reader, you really get lulled into this rhythm of these these stories, and then it turns it at some point, and it makes it that much more effective, because I don't know, I felt like I was right there, you know, feeling the weight of all of those previous stories along with you.
Well, I had a trial run to see if that whole structure would work, because my wife was reading the book as it was coming, as I was finishing it page by page, And I didn't tell her what the plan for the book was. I just sort of would work and she would just each night look at my desk. And there was one night where she's, you know, like the first couple strips I'd finish and she'd kind of crack up and ask some questions about it or something. And then I noticed over the months, the laughs kind of started to dwindle a little bit. And then she'd kind of just look. And there was a certain point where I saw she was just like looking at the latest page and just kind of like raising her eyebrows. And I said, what, not funny enough? What's going on? And she said, well, I know that you told me that this is going to be like 170 pages or something like that. Is it just going to be 170 pages of this over and over again? And so I was so excited. I was like, oh, good. So that's where she's at. That's exactly what I wanted to almost at whatever page that was. I would want the reader to start to kind of start flipping like, I don't know. And then at that moment, then sort of not pull the rug out from under them, but sort of show my hand a little bit.
Your wife is my favorite
character. Yeah, I was gonna say that too. I was like,
she's for sure the hero because
right,
because what we never do, all the indignities and humiliations that we feel with these things, it's crazy that you made your wife also feel that. You know, like we never think that like that these feelings that we have are gonna pass on to the person that we're with, but I think you know like a lot of those scenes. She was made to feel the same way you were, and she had no hand in any of that.
Right. Know? Yeah, that's true. That's true. And she doesn't get to control the retelling of it. You know, like a lot of these are little stories that maybe I would tell when we were having friends over to dinner or something like that. And she would be more than happy to like jump in and say, no, what actually happened was, and she would be able to sort of correct it or, you know, tell it from her more objective point of view or something like that. So yeah, it must be a little frustrating to see me kind of taking ownership of things that she was as much a part of and putting my own spin on it.
But she's cool with it.
Yeah, I have a hunch that she is probably thinking like I could have told this in a funnier way. Like it's in her genetics to her Irish Brooklyn background to sort of be competitive about humor and sort of like, you know, who's going to get the biggest laugh and who can tell the same story in the best way or something. So I don't know for sure, but I suspect that there's a little part of her that's thinking like, oh, that time when we went to the sushi restaurant, I've got a better version of it than that.
Yeah.
It was pretty good. But one of my favorite scenes and, yeah, I got the book and then I read a little bit of it and every chapter or, you know, scene, I was just always just like, oh no, like, oh gosh, oh gosh, no. And then, you know, I put it down cause I was, you know, had to do some other things and my husband was reading it and he was just laughing. He was just like laughing out loud at certain parts. And the one thing, and it was kind of fun to like figure out which were the parts where we like sharing our laugh out loud moment.
Yeah.
One of them that we really loved was the one in the train station.
Oh yeah. Well, all parents probably feel some connection to that story.
Oh, yeah. And just the, when you shouted what you shouted to that woman.
Oh yeah.
It was we just thought it was
the connection I felt to that story was I'm glad I don't have any kids.
but I kind of like how you have these, you know, your family as, you know, and it's kind of fun to have that person in your life who's not all about, I mean, I don't know how much Sarah loves comics or is in a part of the whole comics world, but having that one person that's sort of more objective, like more of the, gives you a different perspective of like, you know, of how crazy or, you know, insane or like, just like you were saying, like.
Yeah, I am sort of, I've never been in that in this situation, and I often wonder about these cartooning couples, you know, like where both people in the relationship are kind of in the same business and are fans of the same stuff and are pursuing the same goals and everything like that. I know some people. I can think of several cartoonist friends of mine who think of that as like a dream come true. Like if only I could find that right person, but to me it seems terrifying. I don't know. I feel like I need that that outside opinion, you know.
Right.
Yeah, agreed. I was wondering, you know, like we're talking about your kids and stuff like that, and has having kids like force you to see like the time it takes to make comics in a different way? Like you were just saying that, you know, Killing and Dying took you 7 years to make, and in that time, let's say your daughter was one, and then when you finished, she was eight.
Yeah.
A huge, like, developmentally, that's like huge. Does that force you to be like, whoa, that took a long time to do, in a different perspective?
Yeah, I think that's the number one thing that has made me, at least for the foreseeable future, never want to do one of these, you know, brilliant, beautiful, ambitious books that you know, win all the awards and become part of the canon. I don't have it in me right now, and I don't want to spend my children's childhood working on something like that. So it might be something that I'll come back to, you know, when they are free of me and they get to leave home and I'm left with my cat or whatever. But right now it just seems, I don't know. There's a few friends and peers that I know who've been in those long protracted creative processes, and they've all handled it well, and they just sort of keep their nose to the grindstone, and sometimes they'll take a break and do an intermediary book and get something else out short in the more short term and then go back to it. I don't know. It kind of sends a shiver down my spine thinking about something like that.
Well, I was looking at the end of the book, and which really got me emotional, like, you know, the letter and you know, especially during this time, you know, we're talking about like how is comics, it just seems so meaningless to be like drawing comics, you know, at this time, and that there's something bigger and more important, it feels like. But at the end, it just seems like it came back to comics, like you had to do comics. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious how this medium, like, why is it this powerful medium that you want to come back to, like going back to the drawing table?
Yeah, I feel like it's even when I want to the most, it's something that I can't fully get away from. You know, every time I finish a book, you know, I think for some people finishing a book is just like, it's another, you know, like Michael DeForge, it must just be no big deal. It's like, all right, there's my fourth book of the year done. Let me just get started on the next one. But for me, it feels like this big, massive event. Like, oh, I've worked all these years on this thing and now it's over. And I often go through a long phase of feeling like, I think I'm done. You know, I mostly dodged the bullets one more time. I didn't get destroyed by the critics, and you know, let me just not tempt fate again. And you know, and so I always go through that whenever I finish a book. I starting at least with shortcomings. As soon as the book is done, I feel like, oh, let me go get a job at an ad agency or something like that. And just like anything other than what I've been doing for the last few years. But it so far just never seems to last. And lately the experience that I've been having is I'll think, okay, I'm going to put comics aside now, and I'm going to try and do screenwriting or prose writing or just anything different, but still kind of creative. And then pretty much anything even slightly different from the working relationship that I have in the world of comics right now ends up feeling so constricted and limited in certain ways, and dependent upon the permission of other people and dependent upon money from other people and all these things that often I never even get to the creative process. It's like I spend all this time jumping through hoops to sort of get permission to do the creative work, or usually fail to get permission to do the creative work. And it's always those experiences that remind me about like how cheap and easy it is to make comics, and especially with my amazing working relationship with Drawn In Quarterly, just the freedom that I have to sort of just get to work whenever I'm ready, you know. That's kind of the greatest thing about it, I think.
Have you always wanted to stick with comics as a reader too? Like, do you have those same ups and downs as a...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have those ups and downs, and also there's different times where it's like, there's too much good stuff coming out. I can't even enjoy it because I'm like trying to process all these great comics. And then I feel like there's long stretches where it's just like, God, can someone do something that I'm interested in, you know? and so, yeah, it's most of the cartoonists that I like and have liked throughout my life are still productive, and they're still doing work that's as good as they've ever done. So there's always stuff to keep looking forward to, and there's new artists to discover. But like I said, it does seem to go in weird kind of feast or famine waves. I don't know. Is that true for you guys too? Or is there just always something exciting every week at the comic store for you?
It's definitely true for me, but I think it has more to do with where I am in my life than which comics are coming out. Like, it's just a matter of like where my, you know, if I'm feeling burned out from focusing too hard on one aspect or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think this quarantine has really made me fall in love with comics and making comics again.
You know? Oh, that's cool. That's great.
You read and so much time to draw.
Yeah.
I'm just like back in love with the medium and just trying to do as much as I can and trying to read as much as I can.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that a lot of really great books and stuff like that are coming out now. And
yeah.
Recently that like made me be able to go back and you know, really get inspired and stuff like that. And one of the things with being in the comic industry and so well illustrated in here is after a while, a lot of that humiliation and dignities and like jealousy and backstabbing and all that kind of stuff, it like takes this art that you fell in love with to begin with, you know? And and I think being in quarantine has really like kind of cleared that out for me for a little bit, you know? And so like, I was wondering how you felt, like, you know, like you said, it like after a while, you know, sometimes you're just like, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to get to an ad agency or whatever. but like, you know, how are you feeling now about the industry as a whole? Like, or like just comics, like, yeah. You know, altogether, like how are you feeling about where we are? Cause it's so different from when
and how it's changed. Yeah.
You know, Optic Nerve and Mini Comics and, you know, getting that deal from Drawn Quarterly. It's a completely different world now.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just to clarify, now that when you said it back to me, I realized that I don't think I ever had a particular fantasy about working in an ad agency. Like, that's more ambitious than any of the other fantasy jobs I had. Like, I always talk about how when I was a kid, I had this fantasy of working in a newsstand kiosk. Like
yes, that's the dream.
Yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
You sell newspapers.
That's yeah, like, you sit there the by snacks? Yourself. Yeah, yeah, have yeah. some snacks. Sit there and read yeah. the newspaper by yourself. Yeah. Occasionally, take some money from someone or something. yeah. But in terms of the industry changing, I know what you mean. I feel like I have enough of a little network of my publisher and my friends, and it sort of is like a little bit of a bubble where we've sort of maintain some continuity over all the years, but yeah, I would say that like I've my career was perfectly timed in terms of to basically parallel like the most drastic changes that the industry has experienced in its history. You know, like to start trying to work in the early to mid 90s, you know, just to jump on at that moment when there was like, maybe something will change. And there was a lot of longing and optimism and wishing if only things could be a certain way. And then to then watch almost all of those things come to be and to become the reality, and then to last even beyond that and see what are the ripple effects of that, and how, you know, there's positives and negatives, you know? So it's, yeah, it's really been interesting. I feel like it was like I sort of jumped on the train at a perfect time to experience all this evolution, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I just now recently started not to hate all the young, amazing cartoonists. You know, being so mad, you know, because their road is a little easier than mine.
Yeah.
You know, and their talent is just so good that you just get so angry at it, you know. And for you, it must be a little neat because, you know, like, say, if someone like Michael DeForge or somebody that is really good right now that you love, yeah, and then you probably talk to them, and in some way, I mean, not to put on you, but like, I'm sure a lot of them say, you know, you were like, you know, like a big inspiration to me at some point, you know.
No, that doesn't happen. No.
Yeah, I think that's I think it's an interesting to see the new generation and to finally let go of like my anger for them.
You started really young, you know, in comics, and now you're like, you know, I think we're all sort of the same age. Mm-hmm. But you know, we've been talking about it in other episodes about how, you know, oh, we're so old now. Like, even though we're not old, we aren't. But just this feeling of we need to do stuff before like time runs out. Type thing.
Yeah.
Do you ever have that? I don't know if you were talking about that when I left, but thinking about where you are now and
I used to feel that, and it's really dropped off for me. And I think I allude to it a little bit in the book, yeah, I don't know. It's probably a function of getting older. I think there's also the fact that, you know, I've kind of been on the same path for so long. You know, I haven't had a lot of detours. It wasn't like I took a year off and did a superhero comic and then came back to do my own personal work or anything like that. I've literally been kind of on the same cyclical process of making my comics or my books, you know, going back to when I was 16 or something like that. So, you know, combination of those things and maybe parenthood too, but I don't know. I really don't have that looming sense of, you know, the life deadline, you know, the ultimate deadline or anything like that.
Well, you will now.
I really feel like if this is the last comic I ever do, then I'm pretty happy with the run that I've had. So, you know, I don't know. I'm totally impressed with my cartoonist friends who are older than me, who've been at it even longer than me, and still have that fire within them of like, I got to do this graphic novel, and then I got to jump into the next one. And then, you know, like, I know people who actually have the next handful of books totally planned out, and they have to just execute them, you know, over the next number of decades or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. Something definitely changed in me, and I don't feel that strongly about making comics anymore. Like I seem to enjoy continuing to do it, and I can't get away from it. But I don't. Yeah, I don't know. The emotional component has really changed for me over the years.
It seems like it might be healthier now.
Like, well, would you think that? It's more. It's more well-rounded. It's more integrated into a life instead of dominating a life. There was a long period, especially when I was living in Berkeley, where I'd go many days without seeing another human, and I would just be in that little apartment working. And you know, the irony is that when I look back on those years, I'm not particularly proud of the work that I produced during that time, but I am sort of regretful of experiences that I didn't have. So young cartoonists, try to find a balance. That's what I would say.
Can we talk a little about Richard Sallis?
Yeah, we should.
Yeah.
You know, you are very close to, I think I only met him a couple of times, but he lived, I live in Oakland on, you know, by Piedmont Avenue. So I'm right here by him, and and his death, like, even I didn't think it would hit me so hard, but it really hit me really hard.
Yeah.
Because he was a cartoonist, and it really messed me up for a little bit. And but I, like, again, I don't know him very well. So I just wanted to see, you know, like, how that his friendship affected you, you know, and then how, you know, his death affected you.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually very worried about the fact that it hasn't fully hit me still, that the nature of our relationship in recent years was that I would only see him every 6 months or something like that, because I live here in New York. And so it always felt like we were just picking up where we left off, even though 6 months or a year had passed. And I think I'm still in the back of my mind convinced that I'm still on that cycle that I've been on, because I've been doing that for, you know, probably like a decade now, where I would go back around the holidays and I'd see him and, oh yeah, remember what we were talking about last time? Yeah, 6 months ago. Yeah, here's another thing. And so I sort of feel like, you know, if I was living in Berkeley and I was back in our old routine of getting together every week and everything, it would have been more of an immediate blow to me. But I do feel like I'm sort of irrationally convinced that I'm still, you know, going to come back whenever I can, and we'll just go have lunch again. And also, the timing was so bizarre that for him to die in the middle of something that, like, maybe the only thing that I can imagine that would, you know, dominate my thoughts more than his death, you know, like to have a global pandemic happening and everything. And so I feel like I don't know that I've even fully processed and accepted the reality of it. And I don't know. I'm worried about that. I have this kind of dread that, you know, whenever normal life starts to resume and I come back to Berkeley for the first time since then, and that it will really sink in a way that it probably should have a long time ago.
Yeah.
Do you have any good stories about, like, the influence he had on you?
Well, I mean, I've said in the past that I feel like that my friendship with Dan and Richard was really like my version of art school, because I you know, as much as I wanted to, I did not go to art school. And I just never really had that special teacher who took me aside and introduced me to art things or anything like that. You know, a lot of people tell that story. You hear artists talking about, like, the one public school teacher who took them to the museum or something like that. Or, you know, I just never had that. And I never had any real formal instruction. And I had a lot of massive gaps in my cultural education in terms of the history of comics, the history of art, music, film, all these things that other people either taught themselves or were instructed about. But getting to know Dan and Richard and spending so much casual time with them, I think that was really a big component of it. You know, like, if you know, I have some friends who I only get to see every couple of years at a comics festival, and we run on stage and answer some questions, and maybe we have time to get dinner or something like that. But to not have any of that pressure and to know that I was going to see those guys at least once a week, if not more, and without any external pressures of having to be anywhere at any specific time or anything like that, but just meeting at Dream Fluff for a donut or something like that, or going to Mama's Royal Cafe or Gilman Grill or any of those places that we hung out at. And it just, I think that allowed a level of connection and kind of random discourse that really ranged much wider than you might have gotten from another kind of relationship. And so for me, that was, it was a profound impact on my life. I mean, I think those are two of the, aside from family, I think those are two of the most important relationships in my life. In terms of influence from Richard, most people would see very little influence on my work based on his work. But I think in a way that Richard would almost take more pride in the way that his influence, I feel, shows up in my life, because he was, as you know, so self-deprecating and so humble and self-effacing about his own work that in a way, I don't think he would like it if he saw me totally starting to adopt the quirks of his style and me trying to do Richard Sala type stories. But if he knew, and I don't know that he ever did, but if he knew how much I learned from him in terms of, like I was saying, just kind of a cultural education, how to live as an artist, how to be a self-employed person, how to manage a career as an illustrator, all these things, I would imagine that maybe that he would feel a greater sense of pride about that than if I drew my own version of his kind of work.
That was nice.
Thanks.
Well, unless you guys have any questions, I have a couple of things I have to ask.
Sure.
People ask me. The first has to do with the title.
I was gonna ask that. Go ahead.
Somebody told me that it might be alluding to something about Murakami or something like that, but I'm not quite sure. I forgot what he was talking about. But does it have anything to do with something like that, or is this just a title that you came up with?
I think I know what that person was talking about, but that's an unrelated thing.
Oh, okay.
Let me try and sort it out. All these different things are swimming around in my mind now. I think that person must have been thinking of a Murakami book that was published in English under the title something like What We Talk About When We Talk About Running.
Yeah.
So that would connect to the running or the runner aspect of the real influence, which was the loneliness of the long distance runner.
Yeah.
But the Murakami thing itself, it was also a little bit of a play on a Raymond Carver book called What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. So I could see the confusion, but I have found myself in some sort of weird tradition now where I guess when I do an autobiographical book, I do kind of a dumb riff on the title of a more famous, more well-respected work of art. So my little kind of mini comic about my wedding was based on a Bergman, I guess it was basically a TV show originally, but a Bergman film called Scenes from a Marriage. And this one is based on the title, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, which was a short story by Alan Sillitoe and was also a film that that I knew of before I knew of the story.
Okay, cool. I'm glad we got to the bottom of that.
Long-winded response. Sorry.
No, that's perfect. That's what I asked. That's what I definitely needed to hear. And I guess the last thing that I have is the design of the book. So I know that we all have questions about the design of this book.
Oh yeah. Well, I can't say it enough, but most of the credit for that has to be given to my friend Tracy Hurren at Drawn and Quarterly, who just has this amazing ability for hearing me describe or looking at a sketch that I send of some crazy production idea I have. So like with Killing and Dying, I had the idea of like, can we print a dust jacket on transparent plastic? And can we print opaque white letters on top of that? And can we have it line up perfectly with the drawing underneath? And you know, she went to great lengths to make that happen and it came out perfectly. And then with this one, it started with a really rough sketch of like a moleskin sketchbook with, you know, I just wanted to make sure that it has this elastic band and that it has this place mark ribbon and that the corners are rounded, and that this is the most subtle detail, but it ended up being the most complicated thing, is that if you look on most hardcover books, just to the right of the spine on the front cover, there's this big indentation where it folds. And I've seen people kind of do fake moleskins and they have that crease in it. And to me, that always kills it, the illusion. It doesn't look like a moleskin if it has that crease. So I said, and if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's figure out how to do a book, a hardcover book that doesn't have that crease thing. And then, you know, it would have been enough of a challenge under normal circumstances, but we sent the files to our printer that we've used in China just in time for the first hints of the outbreak happening there. And so things got put on hold, and then it wasn't long before the whole printing plant actually was completely shut down, and we had to move the book out of China because it just was not gonna get made. So it basically went around the globe. It was a long process being chased by COVID from country to country. So the fact that, in spite of that, and in fact that it was kind of a expensive and complicated production, that Tracy brought it to fruition perfectly is just kind of a miracle to me, and I'll always be grateful to her for her hard work.
The most amazing thing to me about the production of this book is the grid, the graph paper. Mm-hmm. It's drawn on graph paper. Mm-hmm. The most amazing thing to me is that all the panels are on the line.
Oh yeah.
Line up.
It would be so annoying as a printer to line up that all the panels have to hit that blue line, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, obviously some of them are a little off, but it's like, that's amazing. Like, that's a hard detail to get. And I actually noticed, I was like, whoa, it is. Oh, it is. You know?
Oh, yeah. 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 A lot of, I'm glad you noticed things like that, because there's a lot of details about the book that involve, like, what you're describing involved a lot of math that I'm not good at all. Like, it really does come down to some sort of high school level math education that I've long forgotten. But in terms of, you know, because also the artwork was going to be reduced, and I to still have it kind of match up with the grid once it's reduced, and all that was definitely complicated. So I'm glad you noticed it. There have been a few other things where like other like foreign publishers or people doing promotional items have tried to put together their own version of it, and what you described they almost never get. It's always just sort of like the lines of the panel just sort of are just randomly placed over a grid or something like that.
That's hard to do.
Well, this is a
for me, it was hard to do.
I mean, I do have one question, but we could edit it out. And it was from the Randall Park chat. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, what is there something that you're, is there a project in the works with him? Or
yeah, we did mention it a little bit in the video. So yes, we are working on a project together that is so far moving along nicely, but we're still not at a point at which we can announce the details of it. But I'm enjoying working with him a lot, and as you could tell from that video, he's a lot of fun to hang out with.
Again, this is the book here, and honestly, it's amazing. It's one of the best things.
Thanks.
You know, out of yours, I think it's one of the best things. And it was definitely like lived up. Like, you know, a lot of times I'm like, oh, so excited about something, and But it's like definitely, and it's like something that I've been recommending to everyone, and I think everyone should run out and grab it.
Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks. Really nice.
And I do think that it's very relatable, even if you're not a cartoonist.
Yeah. That's good to hear. I appreciate that. I appreciate
And I think it's a book that, you know, it's one of those books you're going to read again and again. You know, those ones that you just have to keep close. And, you know, a lot of your books are like that. But I'm just, it's exciting to see that again, especially the autobio. It's really fun.
Thanks, guys. So, that means a lot to me to hear it from fellow cartoonists and from fellow Bay Area people. It means a lot to me. I didn't, like I said, I didn't know who would read this book. I didn't know where it would go, but it was always my hope that other cartoonists would get something out of it. So I appreciate that a lot.
Awesome. Thank you again for being on the show, and good luck with the rest of your tour.
Yeah. I'm mostly done. So yeah, it was pretty painless. But thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And I, look forward to seeing you guys in real life sometime.
Yeah. See you soon.
Awesome.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Adrian.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Adrian.
Bye-bye.